Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's been close to 20 years since Zadie Smith's debut novel, White Teeth, turned the literary world on its head. Well, this month, Smith is back with another dazzling work. Grand Union is her first collection of short stories, and to read the book is to walk through the world with Smith's brave, omnivorous mind as your guide. Everything from the Brett Kavanaugh hearings to apocalyptic dystopias and road trips featuring Michael Jackson, Marlon Brando, and Elizabeth Taylor. Stories about race and about addiction. The stories are of our time, for our time, and are all also wholly original. She'll join us today to talk about it. And you can join us as well. What questions do you have for Zadie Smith? Have her books or her essays or her stories left a lasting impression on you? Join us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Zadie Smith joins us today from New York. She is a celebrated writer of many novels, including White Teeth, On Beauty, and Swing Time. Her new book is called Grand Union, and it is her first short story collection. We have a link to some of the stories included in the collection at our website, onpointradio.org. Zadie Smith, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Let me ask you first, what does the form of the short story allow you as a writer to do that maybe you can't or is more difficult to do in the longer form of a novel?
I think for me, it's about playfulness. Like even listening to that introduction, when you say 20 years, it really blows my mind that I've been writing for 20 years. It doesn't feel that way to me. But I guess the thing I always fear is rigidity or getting stuck. And stories were just an opportunity to think differently, think about different kinds of writing, different ways of writing. A novel is a very long stretch in one place, you know?
Yeah.
So it was amazing fun to do this.
Well, tell me more about that. Fun how?
Fun for the irresponsibility, fun for the freedom, fun because I didn't have to be just one writer, you know, I could be more than one, and that's exciting to me. And fun because there was a lot of improvisation and adaptation. I started to think about it the way I think about music. You know, if I'm making music or sometimes I sing and so much of that is improvisation. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the chords, but then you work around it. And I thought about how rarely you do that in writing. You get so anxious and so stuck. So I experimented with things like found objects, for example, like trying to write about what fell in front of me on a particular day, something that I think, you know, visual artists do a lot, painters do. I wanted to see if I could do it in language.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you bring music up as a metaphor here, because, as you know, some reviewers sort of brought that same or got that same feeling from the book, and as did I. Like they're sort of like musical phrases here that you can hear or read you experimenting with, and then you move on to something else. As you say, that might have captured your attention for a moment or two. But
right, I mean, to me, I'm not an essentialist about these things, but I do think that deep in diaspora writing and black writing, it mm-hmm. is the idea of rhythm. You know, it's kind of unavoidable. And there's more than one rhythm in the world. What I admire about musicians, and particularly, I guess, musicians in the black tradition, is this instinct for a new tempo, a new rhythm, a new beat. But for me, it's always a kind of variation on the theme. Like stories to me are like an argument, just the same as essays. Like I'm in one place mentally, but there are many ways to look at a blackbird, to put it Wallace Stevens way.
I wonder, I mean, you burst on to the global literary scene at such a young age with White Teeth. Do you feel like that short stories provide you with the perfect vehicle to continue to experiment, even though it has been these 20 years? I mean, do you feel like almost a personal obligation to continue that experimentation?
I always say to my students, I don't think writing is cumulative. I mean, you do get a bit better at it, maybe certain things, more, you have more facility. But unlike other skills, it's always possible to be terrible at it. That's always a proposition in front of you. Every time you write a book, it could be the worst thing ever. That's what's exciting to me about it, you know. I don't see a great difference between me and a student of mine. We have the same possibility in front of a book every time of just being awful. And that's what's kind of thrilling and exciting about it and fresh about it. I guess you can get stuck in a certain mode and then just reproduce books in that mode over and over. But that was never my idea. I always felt like an apprentice and as someone starting out. And I suppose something about what happened to me when I was very young with white teeth made me feel a responsibility to that kind of luck. I felt very lucky and kind of outrageously lucky. So mm-hmm. I suppose in my mind, to justify it, I decided to work hard, retrospectively.
So did you say that you still feel like an apprentice in this craft of writing?
I do. I think I have some kind of arrested development. I know I'm 43, but I don't particularly feel that way. I know that I wrote a book 20 years ago, but that seems to me like yesterday. I don't know. I guess when I'm writing, I lose track of time a little bit. You live in the time of the books you're writing, and then you wake up every few years and realize you got older again. but to me, the time of the books, I guess, is real time, and it's slow progress. You know, you kind of get a little bit better, make a few less mistakes, but learn new bad habits, etc.
I've got to say, I think that perspective of kind of continual apprenticeship in this craft is one of the things that makes you so stunningly talented at it. I mean, just never presuming that you have mastered this. You can see that. I'm risking fawning too much here, but I think you can absolutely see that
stories. I don't know. I presume incompetence. I've always been that way, but but that's good. It's something to aim for, always. I don't know. When I think about music compared to writing, I was thinking about it with my brothers recently, why I didn't become a musician. And to me, it was because, you know, the greatest musicians are so overwhelmingly great that there's just not much point in starting. That's how I feel about Stevie Wonder, for example. But for some reason in writing, even though, of course, the great writers are extraordinary, I feel there's more room for possibility, you know. There's more room for someone who works hard. It isn't just this God-given gift, the kind that someone like Stevie has.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you might talk to us a little bit about one of the stories in Grand Union. It's called Kelso Deconstructed, and I'll have you read a little bit from it if you could. But can you tell us a little bit about this story?
Well, it came about because my mother had gone to visit his grave with some friends. I think they were laying a special plaque. There's a artist in England who lays plaques at the sites of black history, sites which aren't usually recognised by the British state. And so she sent me a picture of this ceremony in this moment, and it just made me think. It made me think about Kelso, who was a young man stabbed to death in a racist attack in the 50s in England. And I wanted to write about him. I felt the strong need to animate him as a human. I was kind of moved by this idea of my mother and her friends going to his grave as if he were a close friend, you know, not just a symbol, not just a name in a newspaper, but someone who deserved their attendance and attention. I found that moving, and I want to try and do the same thing in a story.
So this is, just so folks know, this is based on, as you said, the true murder of Kelso Cochran, right? In 1959,
yes.
He was just, what, 30,
yes.
32 years old.
Right.
And he was murdered by a group of white youths.
Right, okay. Who had previous in the neighborhood, they were kind of running around attacking black people and falling down the street and intimidating them, and none of them were ever prosecuted. And so it's a kind of early echo of Stephen Lawrence, which happened when I was, I think, 15, and of many other killings since.
Well, could you read an excerpt here from Kelso Deconstructed?
Yes. If you align his witness statement to the left-hand margin, it looks like a poem. 50 yards up the road, we sorted out our little argument and turned to go back to the party. When we reached the corner, we saw this black man. lying on the pavement, clutching his chest. Two spades, that's what we call coloured men here, were standing beside him. We decided to get out of it fast. It was not our business. Then when we saw how serious it was, we decided to come clean and tell the lot. I had a lot of blood stains on my clothes, for that matter. All my clothes have blood on them. You know, from one fight or another. Old stuff. We fight a lot here. Life is like that in Notting Hill. The police took away my clothes, but I was in the clear. In the poem, all our British names are used. Black, spade, coloured. But no man appears to claim them. These are not names for Kelso. They name rather a certain kind of malignancy in the brain of Patrick Digby, the poet murderer, whose name, like all proper names, describes him perfectly. Patrick Digby was the man capable of thinking that way and of writing this poem. But a lot of people could write it. It's amazing how many. The possibility of its composition reoccurs at different moments in history, in different places. The details change, but the deep structure remains. A form of tragic verse in which the slaughtered man is a kind of object, and only the poet keeps his proper name.
That's Zadie Smith reading an excerpt from Kelso Deconstructed. It's one of the stories in her first short story collection called Grand Union. Zadie, we only have about 30 seconds before we have to take our first break here, but I wonder, in the process of writing this story, did it help you understand this moment in British history in a different way? Did it change your understanding of it at all?
It made me understand that there's a part of British history that the British don't recognise and don't understand.
Meaning what?
That black British history is British history, and until it's included in our classes and in our knowledge of our own country, it'll be hard for Britain to change and become an adult country, which it has yet to do, in my opinion.
Well, we are talking to Zadie Smith. She has a new short story collection out. It's her first collection of short stories. It's called Grand Union. We will be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Zadie Smith right now. She is the celebrated writer of White Teeth, On Beauty, Swing Time. Those are just some of her novels. She's also author of several nonfiction collections, but she's out now with her first collection of short stories. It's called Grand Union, and we have a link to some of those stories at our website, onpointradio.org. And Zadie, let me just go straight to the phones here, because Alexandria is calling from Columbus, Ohio. Alexandria, you're on the air with Zadie Smith.
Hi!
Hello. How are you?
Thank you so much for letting me connect with both of you today. Both of you have been tremendously profound influences in my life, so thank you so much. My question has to do with what informs the inspiration for the material that you've chosen to write about. I'm sure that that's a broad question, but just even most specifically, your anthology of short stories.
I think the main thing is just trying to be in the world. I always presume that I am exactly the same as everybody else. Like, I have the same low motives. I have the same fears. I have the same reaction to the news. Like, there's nothing special. I start from there because then the assumption is, I mean, obviously there are all the kind of small contingent differences between people, which are many, but I assume that if I feel something, probably a lot of people feel some version of it. So I just try and stay in the world, keep my eyes open. Stories come from the streets of New York, from my family, from my own experience, from stories I read, from the news, anything really. But it usually starts with an idea or an argument. And just as it does with an essay, except in the case of stories, they're fleshed out with people and places. I'm the kind of writer who usually starts from an idea. I wish I didn't, but I do.
So, Zadie, if I may, there was an interview that you gave a while ago, a couple of years ago. I don't even remember who it was from, but I found it online one day. And there was a question that the interviewer had asked you, where they asked you, how do you protect the space of independent thought, right? And your answer was so good that I actually printed it out, cut it out, and stuck it on my monitor at my desk so it can keep me grounded every day. Because you said that you think the writer's job is to try to work as hard as they can to avoid orthodoxies of any kind, bullying of any kind, liberal piety, conservative hubris, all of these things that are natural sort of base impulses in human right. beings, to try and to avoid those things as much as possible. And how do you do that as a writer?
It's different in different times in history, but my answer has been to get out of the algorithm personally. And I totally understand it's a luxury of my life. I don't have the kind of job where I need the phone in my hand. But I also think that there are more people, perhaps, than admit it, who could get out of the algorithm, who could use the algorithm less. You know, I use email to contact people and to be contacted, but I don't enter the hive that often just because I can't think in there. I can't think in an algorithm. I don't feel free.
I see.
So I'm very addicted to freedom. So I try and work outside of it as much as possible. Doesn't mean I'm not a Luddite. I know what's going on online. I can see it when I want to see it. But I don't exist within it. I just can't do that.
Are you saying that, you know, literally to defend your capacity for independent thought, you are absenting yourself from the digital cacophony that most of us are
personally
living?
Anyone who can think in there, I admire you extraordinarily, but I can't. And I've been thinking about it a lot. Like, I read a lot of stuff about the digital world, and it seems to me that the things I love about the internet that you love about the internet probably are asymmetry, the asymmetry between user and crowd, right? So all the things which are extraordinary, like LGBTQ visibility and the sudden kind of voice of black women online, that's all to do with the asymmetry. So one person can speak to many, just as you're doing on the radio now. But there is a second asymmetry between the users and the data harvesters. And that asymmetry is so toxic and so deadly to me that I can't participate in the first one. But I absolutely dream of a generation who find a way to separate these two internets from each other, the one in which we are talking to each other and have a relationship with each other, and the one where we're being manipulated day and night. As long as the two are connected, I can't be in there.
I'm not sure it's possible, because there's something about the act of...
It's possible.
You do?
It's possible. It's possible to code that way. There's nothing inevitable about the way the internet is structured right now. It is possible. But to think inside it means to be consistently nudged day and night. And it's not a moral question as far as I'm concerned. I don't moralize about that any more than I'd moralize about a heroin addict, because heroin is it's built to be addictive. And so is this technology. But it overwhelms the capacity to will and to will individually. And in order to write, that's exactly what I need to do.
To will individually. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know that you're reading or have read Shoshana Zuboff's book.
Right.
Surveillance Capitalism.
Yes.
I talked to her a while ago, several months ago. She's absolutely one of my intellectual heroes right now. Because
she's a hero.
Yeah, because her book is exactly about this, about the capitalistic drive to the digital world we're living in.
Right. It's not about technology. It's about capital. But honestly, if I could make everyone, my policy is going to kill me, but buy that book instead of my book, I would. It's far more important, and she's done an extraordinary thing.
By both. How's that? We'll make
publishers
happy. Yeah. Well, let's go to Darren, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Darren, you're on the air.
Hi. Just a question for Fazili. If you were to look at your first piece of writing in contradistinction to your last piece of writing,
yes.
What would you tell me in terms of what where your confidence would have started at and where it is now as a writer? Thank you.
My very first piece of writing was a perfect act of plagiarism. It was a copy of a Michael Rosen poem, who's a wonderful children's writer in England, which I just copied out and handed to my mother and claimed to have written. So I've moved on from that a little bit. But for a long time throughout my adolescence, that really was what I did. I would type out other people's stories and just repeat them. And I don't think it's bad training. Like, to me, the joy of typing out, I used to type out, you know, Tolstoy stories, it was just the sense of getting that, you know, program running through my brain. But all of that helped get me somewhere a little bit original in the end. But that's the difference, I guess. In the early days, all I did was repeat and copy, read, repeat and copy. And then just now I feel that all that practice has amounted to something. Yeah.
Definitely something, without a doubt. Can I just loop back to something that you said before we had to take that first break about British history, that you said that you don't think Britain has really grown up yet? What did you mean by that?
It's a long process for me of kind of being out of English schools and understanding what was not taught. And fundamentally what was not taught was our true colonial history and the true history of British slavery, which is the equal of American slavery. Just because it was offshore doesn't mean it wasn't significant. All these stories, and there are so many of them, it's not to punish the British, but if you don't know your own history, you are condemned to repeat it, and you are also condemned to be innocent. I think the British idea, which I certainly had growing up, that we were fundamentally on the side of the angels, is not a helpful thing to believe as a nation, because it means you go forward in innocence always. If you think of yourself as a hero, and a lot of the language we're hearing in the papers, I was amazed when I got back to England recently about Brexit, is explicitly Second World War heroic language. Even the smallest article I read in the Evening Standard, house prices are falling, it's tin hat time.
Uh-huh.
So an economic crisis brought on by ourselves for ourselves is described as a kind of wartime attack. You get stuck in these metaphors, and historical truth is a way of escaping metaphorical truth. And I think it would be incredibly healing for everyone in England, black and white, to understand what Britain was in the 19th century. This grandeur that we're always trying to return to was not so grand. And it's important to know that. There's many things to love about Britain. It is an extraordinary place, but it's not an innocent place.
How different is that from how you've observed over your many years of living in the United States with how America grapples with, or maybe doesn't grapple enough with, its history with race?
I don't think it could. It's hard to say whatever could be enough given the history and given its brutality. But from a British perspective, the fact that it is grappled with is significant. And it's hard for Americans to appreciate that because they're dealing with their own historical nightmare. But when I see things like, you know, the American discussion around lynchings, for example, that there should be a record of every lynching, that seems to me so far ahead of the English conversation, where when we talk about reparations, for instance, between England and Jamaica, that is, for most British people, literally a comic joke. So I think, for me, the American conversation is far advanced, and it's been going on far longer. And it's been an honor to be around it.
Yeah. Going back to Brexit here for a second, have you yet written or will you write a Zadie Smith story about Brexit? Because I would die to read that.
It's impossible for me because I don't understand anything about it. I'll leave that to McEwen. I've read many articles, but I've spoken to Ian, but nothing can make me understand its intricacies. It's like a lesson in constitutional politics and parliament. And I tried to learn it, but like every British citizen, I'm completely lost. I'm afraid being a novelist gives you no superior understanding of what's happening in Britain right now.
But don't you think that's exactly what would make you the perfect person to help the rest of us who are equally confused about it?
I don't know. I admire Ian's efforts because I think it's an incredibly depressing subject to write about. And the people running it, this small Etonian gang, I'm defeated by the prospect of thinking about them for more than 5 minutes.
Okay. Fair enough. It does tax the mind more than a little bit. But aren't there hints of Brexit, or at least that sort of and I'm going to use English rather than British, that specifically English mindset in your story, The Lazy River?
Yes. I mean, that's the closest I came. And I was interested in inevitabilism, which I guess Shoshana Zuboff talks very well about the sense of something being inevitable. She's discussing the technology, but Brexit has a similar flow to it. And the only hope for change or for radical change is understanding that inevitabilism is a myth. It's not true. Nothing is inevitable. There's always the possibility of change. So Lazy River was kind of a story about that, yeah.
Well, Zadie, since we're talking about The Lazy River, your story, one of your stories in Grand Union, I was wondering if you could just read an excerpt from that story for us.
Sure. We're submerged, all of us. You, me, the children, our friends, their children, everybody else. Sometimes we get out for lunch, to read or to tan, never for very long. Then we all climb back into the metaphor. The Lazy River is a circle. It is wet. It has an artificial current. Even if you don't move, you'll get somewhere and then return to wherever you started. And if we may speak of the depth of a metaphor, well, then it's about 3 feet deep, excepting a brief stretch at which point it rises to 6 feet 4. Here children scream, clinging to the walls or the nearest adult, until it is 3 feet deep once more. Round and round we go. All life is in here, flowing. Flowing. Responses vary. Most of us float in the direction of the current, swimming a little or walking or treading water. Many employ some form of flotation device, rubber rings, tubes, rafts, placing these items strategically under their arms or necks or backsides, creating buoyancy and thus rendering what is already almost effortless easier still. Life is struggle. But we are on vacation from life and from struggle both. We are going with the flow. And having entered the Lazy River, we must have a flotation device, even though we know rationally that the artificial current is buoyancy enough. Still, we want one. Branded floats, two large floats, comically shaped floats. They are a novelty, a luxury. They fill the time. We will complete many revolutions before their charm wears off, and for a few lucky souls, it never will. For the rest of us, the moment arrives when we come to see that the lifeguard was right. These devices are too large. They are awkward to manage, tiresome. The plain fact is that we will all be carried along by the Lazy River at the same rate, under the same relentless Spanish sun, forever until we are not.
That's Zadie Smith reading an excerpt from her short story, The Lazy River. It's one of the stories that appears in her first short story collection called Grand Union. What exactly are you saying there about torpor and buoyancy in this story?
I was just interested in torpor, that whenever I talked to anyone in all walks of life, that's what was coming across, a sense of despair. For instance, we could have a long conversation about phones and what they were doing to us, and everybody agrees, and then they pick up their phone again.
Oh, yeah.
That is an example of torpor. And I was just interested in that. It's reminded me of something, of addiction, for sure. Everybody knows. I was a smoker for years and years and years until about 3.5 months ago. And I know exactly what smoking is and what it does, but I couldn't stop. I didn't want to stop. Torpor. And when torpor is this huge, when we're all included in it, and when it's part of your means of existence, when you have to make money through it, when you have to talk to your children through it, etc., when it becomes the world, it's very hard to see around the edges. But I think it is important to see around the edges. I think for me that, like, children were the main realization. When I started to think, why should Mark Zuckerberg have my children? Why should he? Why should he decide how they're raised, what they do, what their attention is set on? And all the rest of them are using Zuckerberg as a stand-in for whatever it is, 12 men on the West Coast. They don't own my life. They don't own my ability to attend to things, nor my children's. And I think if anything's going to snap us out of torpor, it's going to be the next generation, right? The thought of them. Mm-hmm. Same with Greta and the climate. It helps to remember the future.
Well, Zadie Smith's new short story collection is called Grand Union. She's also the celebrated writer of a number of novels, everything from White Teeth to Swing Time. We've got some excerpts of the stories, or links to stories in Grand Union, at onpointradio.org. Zadie Smith, it's been an extreme pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Well, after the break, we're going to turn to another great mind. We're going to speak with Nobel Prize winner Dr. William Kalin about his research on how the body adapts to changes in oxygen level and the very personal story about why this prize means more to him than you might expect. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The 2019 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded to three scientists on Monday. They were given the prize for their groundbreaking discoveries on how cells respond to changes in oxygen. Now, their research dates back to the 1990s, and it was fundamental to how doctors treat cancer, heart attack, and stroke. One Nobel Committee member called their work a, quote, textbook discovery that students will learn in the future as early as age 12. Well, Dr. William Kalin is one of the trio of winners. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And he joins us now. Dr. Kalin, welcome to you and congratulations on your Nobel Prize.
Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure to have you. Now, Dr. Kalin, if you could, I was just wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about the fundamentals of the research that has earned you the Nobel Prize this year.
Yes. I suspect most of your listeners are aware that oxygen is essential for life on the planet as we know it. And I think most people are aware that if they don't get enough oxygen, they're not going to survive. But less appreciated is the fact that if you were to get too much oxygen, you also wouldn't be able to survive. Oxygen turns out to be a very reactive molecule, and so it has to be maintained in a fairly narrow window for cells and tissues in our body to do well. So this prize recognizes the work that we did, as well as work done by Greg Semenza and Peter Ratcliffe, that allowed us for the first time to understand the molecular pathway or the molecular circuit, if you will, that allows cells and tissues to sense how much oxygen they're getting and to then respond appropriately. So you can think of it as sort of a molecular rheostat. And so, for example, if you went to the top of Mount Everest and your body suddenly realized it wasn't getting enough oxygen, using the pathway that we've now defined, your body would start making more of a hormone called erythropoietin, which would then allow your body to make more red blood cells, so your blood would become more efficient at capturing and delivering oxygen.
I see. Well, actually, let's just take a quick call. We've already got callers who want to talk to you, Dr. Kalin. Connor is calling from Dover, New Hampshire. Connor, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was just hoping, Doctor, you might be able to explain in fairly technical terms, like you might to a class of seniors, exactly how this this sensing and awareness happens.
I'll try my best. So, the analogy I use is all of us have, for make a nice round number, we'll say approximately 20,000 genes. I'm rounding here, and genes in general are blueprints for making proteins. So proteins do the actual work here. Now, amongst these 20,000 genes, there are several hundred that are devoted to making proteins that would allow you to adapt in a low-oxygen environment. I mentioned one a second ago called erythropoietin, but there are many others that allow cells and tissues to survive in a low-oxygen environment. So I think of those 100 or 200 genes as being different instruments in an orchestra, and the conductor for the orchestra turns out to be a protein that scientists refer to as HIF, or HIF for short. And so when cells are not getting enough oxygen, HIF tells the orchestra it's time to start playing, and you start activating these several hundred genes, and you allow cells to adapt to low oxygen. But that still didn't tell us how cells know whether they're getting enough oxygen. And what we found was that when cells are getting enough oxygen, a little chemical flag gets put on HIF. And once that chemical flag has been placed, HIF is destroyed by another protein scientists call VHL for short. And so that turned out to be the key component of the mechanism, that when oxygen is not present, the flag doesn't get put on, and HIF tells the orchestra to play, whereas when oxygen is available, this little chemical flag, which had never been seen before as a signal within cells, gets put on HIF, and HIF gets destroyed by the VHL protein. Mm-hmm. And what was very satisfying about this is that part of the flag actually is an oxygen atom, and so it turned out to be a fairly simple and elegant solution to how you would sense oxygen, because the oxygen actually gets incorporated into the flag.
Right. Well, Dr. Kaelin, I understand that this insight that you're just describing to us came in part through your decision to study a disease that I had never heard of, von Hippel-Lindau disease?
Yes, most people haven't heard of it, and even many physicians have only encountered it in textbooks, as opposed to in the clinic. So this is a disease that affects about 1 in 35,000 people, and it was described in the medical literature about 100 years ago, although in hindsight there were people in the Middle Ages who had this disease. And these are individuals who inherit a defective version of the VHL gene from either mom or dad, and because they have a defective version of the VHL gene, they develop a variety of tumors. And clinicians such as myself knew that these tumors often produced distress signals that we normally associate with low oxygen. And so this was one of the keys that the VHL gene, or if you will, the VHL protein, was really part of this molecular circuit.
So it was sort of observations that you'd made about people who suffer from von Hippel-Lindau disease that made you think, well, this is a fruitful pathway for research.
That's an excellent word, fruitful, because one thing we always talk to young scientists in training about is the importance of picking a good problem and sort of having a nose where there are discoveries to be made. And one very good choice I made many years ago was to work on the VHL gene for precisely this reason.
But you don't know if it's going to be fruitful or not when you start, right? I mean, because the reason why I'm trying to get to is I've read that you said that you believe in the importance of curiosity-driven research.
Yeah.
Now, one would think that that's the very definition of science. It should be. Is it not? Do we not have enough folks in the lab being driven by or being able to do curiosity-driven research?
Well, unfortunately, the pendulum in the last 20 years has swung, I would argue, too far in the direction of linking support for science to the sort of predicted outcomes or the predicted deliverables. And so I think a lot of young scientists today feel pressured to do things that are going to lead to applications in the short term. And I think that's very short-sighted and self-defeating. I think we do have to allow scientists to follow their curiosity and instincts, because that's often where the biggest discoveries lie. Now, in our case, because of the clinical features of patients with VHL disease, we thought there was a pretty good bet we might learn something about oxygen sensing, and we knew that many diseases are linked to abnormalities in oxygen delivery. So we thought there was a reasonable chance that this would ultimately have applications. But your point's well taken. I think that many incredibly important discoveries started out with very curious phenomenon where the outcomes were completely unknowable. I think, for example, of CRISPR-based gene editing, which almost certainly will be recognized, in my view, with a Nobel Prize at some point. And that really came out of classical curiosity-driven research, studying interesting biological phenomenon without any clear idea what the outcome of that work would be in terms of applications.
I mean, I'll take it even further, Dr. Kalian, and say that I believe in science, great discoveries require unknown outcomes. I mean, if the point of the research is to arrive at a known outcome or a particular desired outcome, that by definition is not a discovery.
Oh, I love you. I mean, this is something I talk to my students about all the time. And, you know, I like to contrast doing science versus doing engineering. For example, one of the defining moments of my childhood was putting a man on the moon. But that was largely an engineering problem. It wasn't so much a scientific problem as an engineering problem. And to your point, I tell my students, you know, engineers live for expected results, but a good scientist should live for unexpected results, because over and over, it's those unexpected results that change the way you think and often lead to the most important discoveries.
Mm. Well, Dr. Kalian, if I may, I'd like to explore a little bit about the personal meaning of this prize to you as well, because I must mention your late wife, Dr. Carolyn Kalian, who was also a professor at Harvard Medical School as well, and a breast cancer surgeon.
Correct.
Can you tell us what this meant to you to win this prize after her death?
Yes. So I met Carolyn when I was finishing my clinical training in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins, and she was a fourth-year medical student. And as you said, she went on to become a leading breast cancer surgeon in New England, and was beloved by her patients. Ironically, she diagnosed herself with breast cancer in 2003, at a time that she was writing a book to help her patients navigate their way through breast cancer care, and she had no idea it would become so personal. But I think for that reason, the book was very compelling and helped countless patients. She survived the breast cancer, but then died of a brain tumor unrelated to her breast cancer in 2015. But she was my partner and soulmate in everything I did. And, you know, years ago, when we would allow ourselves to be silly, we would dream about, you know, what would happen if I did win the Nobel Prize, and, you know, what sort of dress would she wear, and who would we invite, et cetera. So it was obviously a bit bittersweet to get the phone call at 5 o'clock in the morning from Stockholm. And my first thought was that, you know, I hope she's smiling down. I think she is, because this was partly a testimony to the role she played in my life.
Bittersweet is the word, but also hopeful, because, I mean, your research directly has an impact on the development or understanding of cancer treatments, does it not?
It does. I think that we've been very gratified that some of our work has already led to new treatments for kidney cancer, and we anticipate having hopefully some impact in some other cancers as well. At the same time, there's a new class of drugs that is emerging from this work that's going to be used for the treatment of anemia or low blood cell counts. And so that illustrates another point, which is, you know, when you do curiosity-driven research, you know, we can't predict the outcomes, but the only thing we can be sure of is the more we invest in generating knowledge, the more we will eventually have those new treatments. So here I'm a cancer biologist and a cancer doctor, and yet I've helped develop a drug that is going to be used by hematologists and internists to treat anemia. But that's really the way real science works. Real science, I think you have to let scientists follow the road and see where it takes them. And just, you know, again, the only thing that you can be sure of is the more knowledge we can generate, the more we'll be able to have improved outcomes in time. But I understand it's both frustrating, but I would also argue exhilarating that when you're doing science, you don't necessarily know where the road is going to take you.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kalin, if I may, I mean, from my layperson's perspective, part of what really amazes me about your work is that it's basically trying to tackle or actually not tackle, but enrich our understanding of a really basic question, right? I mean, we're talking about fundamentals of human biology or the biology of living cells as a whole. When we take something as common or essential for life as oxygen, yes, and just ask, how do cells like look for, yes, it?
Yes. Yes. And I think, in a way, it's very nice that both my fellow awardees and I are physician scientists, because I mentioned earlier, I think scientists are currently under too much pressure to justify what they're doing in terms of application. And that's particularly, I think, true for physician scientists. But, you know, I feel strongly, as do my fellow awardees, that everything starts with generating knowledge, and that often means stepping back and doing the basic mechanistic work, the fundamental work first. And so I've been quoted as saying there are no shortcuts, because I don't think there are any shortcuts. I mean, real translation happens when you know enough to know what you can do. And so you have to do the legwork first to generate enough new knowledge to really move forward with translation.
It seems as if the Nobel Committee in this year and last are really recognizing work in medicine that's had a direct impact on cancer. I'm thinking of Dr. James Allison and Tasuku Honjo, who won last year for their work on cancer therapies. I mean, Dr. Kalin, is there reason to be optimistic about tackling cancer? Are we getting closer to real cures for a whole variety of cancers?
We certainly are. I mean, actually, you know, I entered the field in the late 80s. In hindsight, you know, we at that time, we didn't even have the first draft of the human genome. And so we didn't even have the parts list to really start to work through these various cancers and figure out at the molecular level, you know, what's really gone wrong in these various cancers. You know, and so I think what's happening is quite predictable, that now that we had the parts list with the publication of the human genome, and we've started to understand which genes are altered in which cancers, we're starting to see a new wave of targeted drugs. I'm sure you've spoken a lot about on your program. But I think right now we're in the window where, with a lot of these targeted agents, they're being used as single agents. And we know that's not going to be able to eradicate most cancers. That what we need for most cancers is going to be, you know, for example, three-drug combination of drugs, each of which is effective on their own. But we're certainly getting there. And I think the recent breakthroughs with immunotherapy are tremendously exciting. And I think that, coupled with some other advances, leaves me hopeful. But I always, you know, warn people, it's not going to be one fell swoop, as you well know, because at the molecular level, you know, breast cancer is quite distinct than, for
right,
example, colon cancer or lung cancer. So we're learning the rules for the different cancers, and, you know, we are making progress. Obviously not fast enough, but it is coming.
Well, Dr. William Kalin is the 2019 Nobel Prize winner in Physiology or Medicine. He shares the award with Peter Ratcliffe at Oxford University and Greg Semenza at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Kalin is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute as well. Dr. Kalin, congratulations once again. Thank you so much. And I definitely hear your call for more curiosity-driven research in labs across America.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated. and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.